So welcome everyone to System Thinking Ontario, another in our taking advantage of the distance meetings. So today we're going to have an interesting conversation with Doug Schuller, who I would actually say outside of Christopher Alexander may have written or edited the most number of patterns that's actually been published. So it'll be interesting going through that. What I put up in the beginning is something that people can take a look at if you have another screen, labs.publicsphereproject.org. And this is work in progress that Doug has been working on. I'm going to ask him later on to kind of take us through some of, people can actually choose whatever pattern they're interested in. But one of the problems I see with the pattern language and patterns in general is that people get really abstract quite quickly about patterns. Having concrete patterns is really helpful to having a discussion about, well, how does this feel? How would you use it? What circumstances does it bring? What sort of conversations does it bring? These sorts of things. So we'll do the usual going around and have people introduce themselves. We'll ask a different question this time. So the question we'll ask is introduce yourself and how much do you know about pattern language, and have you come about it in a come about it, come across it before, or have you used it before? And I'll call out people. I'll go around and randomly, I think, because I have a strange interface. I can only see a few people at a time. But let's see, Zad, say hi.
Yeah, hello. My name is Ad Khan. Excuse me. I'm a graduate from the Strategic Foresight and Innovation Program. That's how I came to Systems Thinking Ontario. Regarding the question, I'm not ultra familiar with pattern language, but I've heard of it and I've been learning alongside David Ng and some others that were working on some systems changes, and that's where I kind of heard about it and the Christopher Alexander work as well, but I don't have an advanced knowledge about it at all. But so that's in interesting to be here today. Thanks.
Thanks, Ad. Gary?
Yeah,
Oh,
hi.
hi there.
I'm Gary Metcalf in Ashton, Kentucky. I heard about pattern language mostly when David got involved, I guess a number of years ago, and didn't really know an awful lot about it. But my current interest has come from recently running across pattern language as a part of permaculture. So my real interest at this point is trying to understand how pattern language fits into that in a way that the foundations of both permaculture and maybe the implications of pattern language can be applied to organizations as they're interested in sustainability.
Thanks, Gary. Samia.
Hi, this is Samia Hussain. I'm outside right now, so I cannot talk, but I was a student of OPAD University, and that's how I got to know systems language, and I'm interested about it.
I think
Thanks.
just turn on the camera.
Robert, say hi.
We could.
Hi, I'm calling in from near Toronto in Markham. I guess I was trying to think how I encountered pattern language. Likely the first time would have been somebody talking about the Groupworks pattern language deck, and then I think I more formally dove in after meeting David. And I think the first Systems Thinking Ontario meeting I went to was a presentation David gave on pattern language and Christopher Alexander's work. And more recently, I've been exploring and playing with the Federated Wiki open source software project, which is pretty explicitly about being a tool for creating pattern languages, though I should say I hadn't played with creating patterns or full languages myself, but just sort of interested. I'll stop there.
Thanks, Robert. Elena, and I see Penelope there too.
Hi, you want to go first?
Hi, I'm Penelope Colville. I have been a member of the American Society of Cybernetics since 1986, and I practice educational cybernetics. And I'm very interested to hear your lecture on a pattern language. I've heard of it, but I don't think I know that much about it.
And I'm Elena Leonard, also in Toronto. And I've seen a couple of presentations. And I think what I'm most interested in is to see if there's any relationship between pattern language and discussions and the way that syntegration dialogue happens.
Thanks, Elena. Natalia, say hi.
Hello, all. I'm also based in Toronto on the banks of the Humber River. Heard about Christopher Alexander's work back in undergrad through my interest in architecture and the design of cities. Wouldn't know too much else beyond that. My connection to systems started with climate change and interning with ECCC, Environment and Climate Change Canada. And that's about it for now.
Thanks. Kirk, say hi.
Hello. Yeah, I was building a house with an architect a few years ago. And the architect was trained by Frank Lloyd Wright, went to Taliesin West. So I said to him, oh, good, can we do the bubble thing? And he's like, no, we're not going to do the bubble thing. And you can imagine the competition between Christopher Alexander and Frank Lloyd Wright. So I was like, oh, put in my place. Anyway, yeah, I've read some of the first pattern book. Pretty amazing. It's kind of like a poem overlaying different patterns on top of each other. Seemed really powerful.
Thanks, Kirk. Griff, say hi.
Hey, everybody. I'm Griff, nice to meet you. I'm coming out of Waterloo in Guelph. And I think I first heard of patterns quite a long time ago. I also had a few friends who built some houses utilizing some of this. But more recently, through David in this group and through Scrum as well, which is something I'm interested in.
Thanks. Jim.
Hello, everyone. This is my first meeting, so good to be here. I'm in my first year doing a PhD at the University of Waterloo in the School of in Social and Ecological Sustainability. I don't know much about pattern language, but I've an introduction in systems thinking and complexity from Santa Fe. I did their online course, which was very interesting. And I'm working with crafts and skills livelihoods, and I'm interested in the stories that arise from them and practitioners of them in forming new ideas about economic structures. So be really, really interesting to see what's going on.
Thanks.
It's really good, by the way.
Kelly, say hi.
Hey, I'm Kelly Okamura. I'm calling from downtown Toronto. Certainly, I've got most of my reference to pattern language through working with David Ng, and did some really quick a look onto the public site, and went into a number of the different pattern languages patterns. My original background is in visual communication, so I'm really interested in this in terms of doing work or communicating for social good. Really looking Thanks. Forward to it.
Thanks, Kelly. Josh?
Hi, folks. My name is Josh, or Yoshi. I go by him pronouns. I'm a grad student with OCAD University in the Master of Design for Health program. I'm currently enrolled in the course with Peter Jones in systems design thinking and whatnot. So I'm happy to be here, and I have very little awareness or no awareness of pattern thinking. So I'm looking forward to learning more. Thanks.
Thanks. Carrie.
Hi there, my name is Carrie. I'm a current student of the Strategic Foresight an innovation program. Similar to Yoshi, I'm under the direction of Peter Jones. I'm still in his systems thinking, and yeah, happy to learn more. Happy to be here.
Thanks. Christine?
Hi, it's my camera's not very good here. It's Christine Martin, and I'm a recent grad from the SFI program, and I don't know a lot, but curious to learn more.
Thanks. Bev.
Oh, hi. I am actually currently in California, but I am a student at OCAD and have just finished a course with Peter Jones in same as Yosh and in the same class as him. And Peter's just instilled a real great interest in systems learning. And I have no clue what patterns are, but I'm always happy to learn. So thanks.
Thanks. Peter, say hi.
Hi. I was introduced to the magic of pattern languages through Jim Coplin, and he is at AT&T Bell Labs, and it's transitioned to, was it Lumina or whatever it was in the 90s for a while. There was the movement before Agile became really well known or well understood in the development of pattern languages for software engineering. And that's the world that I worked with. I worked with engineers and large platform design, and we started looking at that approach. And that led me to Christopher Alexander's book, Pattern Language, which I just thought was beautiful and well-conceived. And then I found the permaculture people were using it a little later on, like others have mentioned. And then I've put a couple of other references into one Jim Coplin's books, but also to, I don't know what it is at the West Coast, Doug, maybe you can tell us about this, but you know, I know Tom Attlee from the National Coalition for Dialogue and Deliberation. He was one of the contributors to the GroupWorks deck, which we started using in our design with dialogue and also in our OCAD training. I use the GroupWorks deck. In fact, I used that deck with the Design for Health course that Beverly and Yoshi are in, and might not have really emphasized that was, you were learning a pattern language and we were exploring the GroupWorks cards out of the GroupWorks deck. And so that was a Vancouver, Seattle project, I think, or wherever Tom, I think he's Seattle, right? And then Tom also had recently developed the Wise Democracy pattern language, which Natalia also in the call had talked about her experience. I mean, that's that we had recently done a session with the Wise Democracy deck, well, I guess recently last year. Now, so we've been using these tools and actually, Doug, I know your book and had used it in our first term at the OCAD University's Strategic Foresight and Innovation course as one of the research methods books in our first year, figuring out which book was going to work well with our students. And our students really, it was the Liberating Voices. It's an excellent book for the type of social design that a number of our students are interested in.
Thanks, Peter. Joanne, say hi.
Hi, Joanne from Toronto suburb, Richmond Hill. I am familiar with the pattern language from a technology software development perspective. I've developed software patterns while working for IBM Canada as a technology and systems architect. And I've attempted to design patterns to solve systems interoperability problems in the past. And I, because of that, that led me to Christopher Alexander's books several years ago, I think in 2014. So I've actually read both of his Timeless Ways of Building and a Pattern Language. So I'm curious to find out what Douglas will be sharing with us today from a complex systems perspective.
Thanks. Dan, say hi.
Hi. Oops. Hi, I'm Dan Ng from Toronto. As far as my first exposure to pattern language, okay, so I have to tell a quick story. I was sitting in a System Ontario meeting. I think we were at 192 Spadina. And David comes into the meeting there with like his knapsack full of these books on pattern languages. I think they were both pattern lines. He throws out the knapsack, the books all fall on the table. I'm going, okay, so that's good. And I discovered that, you know, this whole Chris Alexander thing is quite the deal, because here's a guy that was doing like buildings and suddenly we're using patterns in software development, as Joanne said. So that was really a big sort of a aha moment for me. And the other thing is that I was caught off guard the other day. David said, you know, patterns are different than pattern languages, right? I said, no. So there you have it. My sum total of everything I know about pattern languages. Thank you. And hope you guys. Oh, one last thing. I'm going to challenge Douglas Schuler, to our speaker today, to kind of relate toys on the ground with patterns. So this is a very big topic for me. I got to see how he does that. Thank you.
Thanks. Right before Doug, so I'm David Ng. The way I came through pattern language was that at IBM, in effect, I was doing a lot of methodology work, and the IBM Global Services method was pattern language. I also ended up working with IBM Research, and my colleague Ian Simmons had said, oh, I'm working with the world's best programmer. And I go, how can you possibly say that? And he says, I'm working with John Blasidis. And John Blasidis is one of the original authors of the Design Patterns book, which is the so-called Gang of Four book. So I said to Ian, oh, maybe you're right. Maybe you do have one of the world's best programmers working with you. So I've been, since 2014, I went to the PLOP conference, the Pattern Languages of Programming conference, the Purple Sock conference, which is in Europe, which is the pattern languages for social change, the Pearl conference, which is the architecture conference out of the Portland Urban Research Lab, Asian PLOP. So I've been to pretty well all of them. And Doug and I have met. One of the things that that Peter will appreciate is that since Doug's in Seattle, I'm in Toronto, the question was, well, are we ever going to meet? And when I finally got around to it, he was headed for Shanghai, and it's kind of like, oh, well, I'm going to be there. And so we ended up meeting in Shanghai, touring around a little bit. And for Peter's benefit, we have a photo of him, me, and Susu eating vegetarian Chinese food, I think. So anyway, so with this, I'm going to briefly stop the share and invite Doug to introduce yourself. And I guess, Doug, we can do this more of a conversation to start off with, but I guess the question is, how did you come to pattern language, and what's the story behind this public sphere project?
Well, boy, I remember being in, when I was still teaching, and sometimes we'd go around in the class and everybody would say what they're interested in. And I was always just sort of bowled over, because there's so many different interesting perspectives, and sort of they're all in one place. And you think there's some immense kind of possibility just sitting in one room, you know, and I had the same thought then, and I'm hoping to get to a lot of those, the comments and questions before, but when I was, I remember like the first moment I found out about the pattern language work. I was, my last year at this school, Evergreen, which I ultimately taught at for 21 years, it's kind of an alternative school south of Seattle. And it's very interdisciplinary, and there's no grades, and there are no required courses, and it's, you know, it's certified and whatever, it's fine as a degree granting institution, but it's kind of interesting to get cut a deal with the creditor, the credentialing or whatever committees, because we have to show how the graduates got through and got an education. And so we do it with written evaluations, which was a real pain, but I think really good for learning. But anyway, the program that I took at Evergreen was called Toward Humane Technospheres, which is kind of a strange name. But in fact, that last year I was at Evergreen, I lived in this shack that that this friend of mine had land close to school. So I said, you know, can I build a, well, I don't want to make a long, too long a story out of it, but I asked if I could build my little shed or shack there, this 12 by 12. And my friends and I put it up in an afternoon. I stayed there in a year, just banging it together sort of haphazardly. But I was there, and my professor of the Toward Humane Technospheres, he had us reading Alexander's book. And I thought, this is like the coolest thing. And I guess it stuck with me that you could write a pattern language about anything. And this is like on page 3 of his book, and of the pattern language book. And it must have stuck with me, because then, you know, forward on, you know, 20 some years, I was organizing a conference for computer professionals for social responsibility. And it was pretty open-ended for people that were doing kind of civic technology and community radio and some of the community networks, things that were happening before, you know, Amazon and Google came in and just, you know, outspent everybody $1,000 to one. I remember reading about, a friend of mine said, you're so hip on the patterns, why don't you have a call for patterns instead of a call for papers? And we got like over 100 different pattern proposals. And so those ultimately morphed, you know, by one way or another into my book. And you know, I don't know how many of those original pattern proposals actually made it in. I don't know if I ever counted, but maybe a quarter, maybe, I don't think a half, maybe a third. But and so that was the sort of the origins of why I became interested in pattern languages, but also how the Liberating Voices pattern language came about. And we hadn't even thought of a book or anything when we were organizing that conference. And then all of a sudden we saw that we had so many cool ideas that were all the way from the sort of intellectual, very high theory sort of stuff to kind of more precise, very specific ways of organizing and, anyway, so then we just took that sort of raw material and just kept working with the different authors. Ultimately, there were like 85 authors in the book. So we sort of crowdsourced it. You know, I don't know how many years before the word crowdsourced came along, but that's the way we did it. And so I guess then the evolution of the book has been how do we use it? And then we can get to these things later, but how do you use it, and what kind of impact can it actually ultimately have? How can we squeeze as much value out of it as we think is possible to squeeze? And so that's kind of my latest sort of obsession, is trying to get, trying to imagine how this pattern community writ large could be actually provide as much value as possible in dealing with these problems that we're faced with. And I think there's really a strong potential match between the types of problems that we have, climate change, et cetera, and this sort of pattern language approach. I consider it more, you know, if it's going to be opened up, you want to be able to accommodate all the different versions. I think we're all in this, in the sort of the spirit of Christopher Alexander, without necessarily being taking his work as absolute truth, stricture, you know, very sort of doctrinaire discipline, open it up.
Let's play a little game here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to share the screen again, and we have all the patterns. And so, someone put into the chat which one of these patterns you'd like to discuss, because we can dive into them, and then we can get a feel. Maybe we'll do like maybe two or three of these. So whoever puts the first in the chat, just yell out, "Civic intelligence." Okay. Okay, Doug, can you kind of step us through what we have here?
Sure. I'd be happy to. The top part, before the picture, it's got all these different tags. We haven't used those tags much, but all the patterns are tagged. And if there were some sort of repository where lots of different patterns could be involved, they could be tagged in some way like this. But so civic intelligence, this is, I was kind of the, you know, there's different ways of pulling this collaboration together. I wouldn't say I was a tyrant, but I was the person that was, I don't know, the last word, you know. We didn't have big arguments or anything. Anyway, but civic intelligence, we organized these things. We played around with different ways of organizing this whole big pile of patterns that we wanted to assemble into one pattern language. And finally, we ultimately just decided we would do it like Alexander did it. You start with the broadest, the most general, and then you work through kind of to the most specific. And so civic intelligence, I thought, was kind of the broadest, maybe the most important, maybe just one of them, but everything that we were doing, we want to do every project. You want to really leave the civic intelligence higher. I'm not interested in things that turn over all the problems to a computer. I think that we're not at that point yet, and anybody that, anyway, we're not at that point yet. So just civic intelligence is basically how smart groups of people are and societies are in addressing the problems that face them. If you look over on the right, it says English, Arabic, Chinese, French. We have a pattern card for each of the patterns. This is what you're seeing now, is the text that's online, but it's also in the book. And so, but then we came up with the idea of cards. And I did see the French. What happened to it? Oh, it automatically translated it for you.
I have to turn off the automatic translate on this thing. So sorry, it was in French. Just Google decided we should read it in English.
Yeah, well.
Let me try that again. Okay, French.
Yeah, so, well, it's did it again. Oh, no, it's back. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, some languages we have, just this is the card version. So this is what's on a physical card that we use in workshops. And so it's just a short form, very short form of the pattern. And it's not divided into problem, solution, discussion, et cetera, like the sort of long form. But But I have all, we have all the cards, I mean, all the patterns in the Liberating Voices pattern language translated into, we have a whole set in, I don't think French, Arabic, Chinese, Spanish, Vietnamese. Yeah, I guess so there's five full decks. But then we have a lot of other things like Korean, I think we only have like two. Russian, we have maybe 15. And so if anybody ever, in fact, Japanese isn't here, but at one of these conferences, these Japanese people that are very interested in pattern languages said, oh, we would like to translate. And they just wrote to me yesterday and they said they have all the patterns translated that are used in our activist mirror game. And I think that might be worth showing, but so anyway, this civic intelligence is divided up in this kind of more or less the same things as Alexander's. Ours is different. We have the problem, the context, the discussion. In Alexander's book, context only points to other patterns in the pattern, in the pattern language. And ours, we have a context that's actually the context where this thing would be used. And then if you scroll up, David, or back to the top, all of these are similar to his what they call a context. And each one of these, like often if you'd use the civic intelligence pattern, you might use social dominance attenuation, you might use global citizenship. And so we tried to kind of come up with a rich kind of a network of how the patterns were related to each other. We learned a lot, like, you know, I would say almost any two patterns in the Liberating Voices things you could use together. And with the Alexander's things, you know, some are just about a room or they're just about a building. And so if you're building a room, you might not care about independent regions or sleeping in public or some of them. So, yeah, so I don't know what else. This is one of the patterns. Let's
try another one.
Yeah, let's go with another one.
Okay, so we had a request after that for the commons.
Okay, well, the commons is very, you know, it's interesting that we did these. The first three are, I really think they do offer some sort of a summary of the whole thing. And the commons is, you know, there's another, in fact, there's another pattern language that just came out on the commons. And so one of the things that we've always said is that these are things are sort of fractal. You could take the commons and make a pattern language out of it. And somebody did. But this is just basically trying to say that really we have to govern ourselves as a commons because we're not in it by ourselves. And so this is talking about different ways to bring about thinking about a commons and trying to do things with it. And this is done by a commons scholar, this David Bollier. He's been working in the field for a very long time. And so he put this together. It's a, you know, I guess the main threats to the commons would probably be corporations, banditry, big corrupt officials. I didn't really mention it, but one of the reasons that I kind of wanted to do this, one of the things that one of my critiques when I first read this in the 70s was that it really, it doesn't acknowledge all the heat that you're going to get when you try to do something that's against the regular way of doing business. And so there wasn't anything about politics or negotiation or, you know, but anyway, so that's the commons. You can tell a lot if you just look at the pattern card too. It's interesting. I met the guy, this is sort of not even germane, but the guy that started Odwalla, the fruit juice company. I don't know if you've heard of that, but I showed him my book and he said, you should do cards. I went, cards? We just did a 500 and some page book. Now you're telling me you want, you know, one paragraph. But anyway, it was a great idea, and I knew, and so we did those workshops. In fact, the day before, the David and I went around Shanghai, I did a workshop at the Incubation Hub Shanghai, and it was great because we had a full deck of the patterns in English, and we had a full deck in Mandarin Chinese, and so it was kind of interesting to have the sort of the dual language workshop. That was the first time we had done that. So that's the commons. Any others that kind of strike your fancy that are farther down in the list, maybe?
Demystification and re-enchantment, when that's requested.
Okay. I mean, this is kind of one of my favorites, and we didn't know where to put it exactly, but it's arguably the most open-ended of them all, but basically it was saying, kind of suggesting that we need to be rethinking a little bit of what we call sacred and what we're considering, you know, so people sort of treat technology like it's delivered from the gods. And so, you know, I like to say, well, this is the way it's done. It's not smoke and mirrors. This is, you know, we've got these servers and we've got this, you know, so you demystify technology, but then you try also to put the enchantment back in things like life and art and being together and, you know, just sort of, I don't know, maybe this gets back to the toys all over the floor that somebody was asking me about. There, I didn't put them there, but my three-year-old grandson did, and there's some sort of enchantment going on, and it's just like a joy to watch. And I can hear him in the background, because anyway, he's over today, he's letting us do this, I guess. But anyway, so that's the demystification is sort of taking the mystery out of things that shouldn't be mysterious, like technology, and putting the enchantment back. I got it from this book called Reenchanting Art, and the author was saying, you know, instructing people in how to do art or encouraging them, that's a form of art in itself. And just, I like the idea of just sort of trying to re-enchant things. So this is kind of the R1 mystery wild card.
Okay, so I'm going to stop the share because we've gotten people a little bit of flavor of this. And so,
yeah.
I'm not sure if I've asked for questions, and people can type into the chat and ask questions or just give impressions. Anyone?
You know, I can just throw in that Kelly was asking about dumbing down, and one of my students, right in the middle of something else, sort of jumped up and said, we have got to do anti-patterns. And so I thought, that's a terrible idea. And why are you, you know, you're supposed to write them in a positive light. And then everybody in the class goes, we have to do that. And so then the next quarter, because it was everywhere, I could pull it off. We spent the time coming up with a set of anti-patterns. And it's kind of the problematic in some ways. And so that was a school project that sort of was a byproduct of the whole pattern language. And I thought it was very kind of valuable. And really, I think we're making a big mistake when we don't sort of acknowledge sort of the dark side. I mean, the U.S. was just about brought down 6 months ago. Oh, what QAnon? What Trump? What? I mean, this is a political thing, I know, but this is part of a waking up. We don't assume that these things are done in some sort of vacuum when there aren't people that really want to undo everything you want to do. And I don't want to use their weapons. I mean, I don't really want to use weapons at all, but not ones that are physical. But anyway, so I think that the dumbing down, and the pattern languages themselves do have this problematique woven into them, because each one has a problem statement, but it's not, it's distributed all around. I don't know, but that was an interesting thing. But yeah, I'll let somebody ask a question or make a comment.
Bev, would you like to make a comment?
No, I just think my little question asks it. I do love the demystification and re-enchantment, and it just, as you explained it, it just was really quite mind-opening. But I'd like to know your process in developing it, how the ideas came, and then if you've seen this particular one used, and I see another question below, or others used, and their application in community or in organizational settings.
I mean, in a general way, my mind has always sort of rebelled against the people trying to get the one ring or the one thing that sums it all up, when I just have never seen one thing do it all. And if it does, then it's at a level that we can't use, like, E equals MC squared. I guess you can use it if you're going to make a nuclear weapon, but, so I'm interested in kind of the holism that the patterns can sort of provide, and I just, in my mind, I've always been, with that demystification, it was sort of with Computer Professionals for Social Responsible, we wanted to just demystify computers and not let people think, they never make a mistake, and AI, that's going to be smarter than anybody else, and plus it's going to be wise and fair and just, and what is this, a God you're talking about, or what is this? I thought it was just a computer over here. And then the re-enchantment came from the book. But I have to say that, you know, sometimes I'll hear a presentation and I can sort of jot down five or six patterns that people are using. I would say they are using the pattern, but they have never consulted, as far as I know, my book. And so I don't really have a success story for these necessarily. Plus, so there's, somebody could come up to me and say, we used your demystification and re-enchantment pattern and it was great. You know, we came up with a very successful project, but I don't know of them. And there's no mechanism for me to necessarily find out. I know the ones we've used in class, you know, like there's Activist Road Trip in the book. And one of my students said, we have to go on an activist road trip. And so ever since then, we went on at least one activist road trip a year for the last 8 or so years while I was teaching at Evergreen. And also this thing that we did at Incubation Hub Shanghai, my students from Shanghai, this Xingwei college, they came and this was our activist road trip. I said, should we go on an activist road trip? They goes, yes, we want to go on an activist road trip. And so we went. Part of this sort of big dream that I have, and I sent David a copy of this paper that shows what we're trying to pull off, this sort of vision, it would have more of this mechanism feedback thing built in. Somebody say the pattern, there's a pattern and it exists online and you read it and you say, well, we tried this and this is what we did and it didn't really work because maybe this. And so they comment on it. Somebody else comes along, they want to use that pattern. They look at it and they said, oh, here's what these other people said about it. So it's to think of it more as a locus for communication.
That brings us to Jim's question. Jim, would you like to ask your question?
Sure. Yes, thanks very much. The question was just, can anyone create and submit a new pattern?
Well, the way our system is the one that we have now, not at the labs, just at www.publicsphereproject.org, that anybody that has an account can add a new pattern. And so they're not necessarily adding it to the Liberating Voices. In fact, they're not. I mean, it's because we've got, there's a tag. And so within that system, we have those anti-patterns. We've got one year I taught with a woman she's a medical doctor, but also she's a master's in public health person too. And so she said, our program was called, public thinking and public health. And so the civic intelligence and the public health stuff came together. And we and the students made up a public thinking and public health pattern language. And so that's resides on our site. Also, all these translations are there. And one of the problems is that when they changed, they upgraded or whatever Drupal to like this new version, we never really made the transition because we didn't know, we don't have the programmers to do it. So it's not as trivial as just going in. I still know how to give people accounts on our system, but it's not the way it should be, you know. But yeah, anybody can do it. It's an interesting that's part of this vision, is to have these different pattern things come together. And one of the things is, for example, say you're a big fan of Christopher Alexander's stuff. I mean, I am, and other people are. And so you say, what patterns did you use in your house? You don't say, I used all 253 of them. Nobody used, you know, you don't. You use a subset. And so why wouldn't you use the subset of Alexander's stuff if you were building, use the group works people to, so you negotiate, say you're working together as there's a team, you're a consulting group and you want to have a new office and you want to have a retreat center. I don't know. And so you bring in Alexander stuff. You might bring in something from Liberating Voices, de-enchantment, re-enchantment. And so there's no, the way I see it, there's no law that says you have to only use from one system, you know, one language. And that's where I respect the idea of a language where there's all these things are grouped together around a single domain, but life and knowledge, et cetera, don't really work that way. And so we might as well let people mix and match. And so.
Yeah, that may lead us actually towards Gary's question. Gary?
Yeah, thanks. So just to understand, I don't know where you can see me or if you can, but anyway. So would you describe the focus of your work as being primarily identifying the patterns more than necessarily using patterns in a more applied way? I mean, you are taking like a consulting practice and going into places and having people use them. You're really identifying patterns, and then people are taking them themselves and, you know, understanding them, learning them, designing their own. Is that the way you describe the focus of what you've been working on?
Well, that might be what I have been doing, but it's never been my, I don't know about never, but it's not my focus. It's not what I want to do. In fact, okay. That's one of my critiques with the whole pattern language community is it's been so focused. It seems to me, and I don't really want to claim that I know the whole thing, but there's all this focus on writing a pattern language and putting something together. And there's been, seems to be less of a focus on how do you use these? And so really right now, in fact, this Opus Magnum thing that I would share with anybody that wants to see it, because we're looking for reviews desperately. David has a copy, but I want these things to be as useful and as accessible as possible, and think, why aren't people using them? I mean, in the architecture thing, the architecture world, because I've gone to this Pearl conference lots of times, and they're always very accepting. They welcome, you know, got to present their various aspects. I presented on the anti-patterns, you know, so they want to open up, even though it's still primarily architecture, but they say, why is like the new, oh, I forget now what it's called. Does anybody know about that? It's a seaside planned community, the new urbanism, I think it's called. There's this trend or movement in architecture called new urbanism. And, you know, some of these architects say, why aren't we as popular as them? And I think, yeah, I don't really know. I'd like to help you figure it out, because, you know, I think we've got some really strong things to offer, and but I don't think we're anywhere near the sort of the potential that we could have. And you were looking at the permaculture, right, Gary?
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, I've had some students that were interested, and there's these people did do a whole permaculture pattern language too. I've seen that. And it seems like if you're talking about any sort of large scale concept where there's that's not simple, mm-hmm. you know, where it actually is complicated, then that's a good place for a pattern language. And so I was really happy to see the permaculture, and there's the new towns people, I think, in their transition towns, it's called, something like that. They're in England, it's bigger. they came up with a pattern language. There's people doing mutual aid pattern language, and they're, I think, kind of in your backyard. I think they're in North Carolina. Is that where you were, Gary? Or?
In Kentucky, but it's close. Kentucky.
Okay. Yeah. Close enough. No, yeah. Not really. But anyway, so you're doing mutual aid, and all these things are very interesting. And I really don't know how to squeeze all the value out of it, but I'm certainly pushing it. You know, I think it's a good sort of a have a Green New Deal article that if I can do it, I'll put up the link there. But it was trying to make kind of a very, very draft version of what a Green New Deal pattern language might look like, because, you know, Korea's doing a Green New Deal. And I mean, the concept is traveling, and people feel the urgency of really getting the job done, you know, of dealing with climate change without necessarily throwing a few communities out into the ocean and say, well, we had to, you know, you got to throw them away because then we could do better for ourselves. Or, and so I don't know where I was going exactly with that, but one of the things I think that we could be doing is having sort of crowdsourcing, if you were, pattern languages that actually could help bridge the help bring these communities together. I mean, you know, government is working on climate change, but so are some local businesses, and some community groups want to help figure this out. And you know, Black Lives Matter, does that factor into it? I sort of think it does. You know, if it's all about how we are managing ourselves,
yeah,
or not, you know.
Just a quick follow up question, then I'm going to get off and let other people get in. But I wonder if it would be feasible or useful to work at identifying some of the patterns that have actually caught traction. In other words, you know, why the particular seaside kind of, you know, new design caught on as opposed to the others? You know, why are we not living in Bucky Fuller geodomes? You know, really good ideas, but they just didn't catch the traction. So identifying the things that really did catch on, I wonder if there's a place to look for those.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that part of it is probably just, I mean, the new urbanism is kind of I don't know if I hope there's no fans in it, but it's sort of like what you might like it's like yuppie architecture kind of. I mean, it looks like it's sort of homespun, but it's all sort of canned. And yeah. Disney was one of the big investors in it. So,
okay.
You know, I don't want to say it was, I don't know. I mean, I'm not an architect, but, and also I do think that there's fads. And if you're not along with the fad, the way things are going at the moment, you know, we were trying to do these community networks, you know, computer community networks back in the 80s. And that was at the high water mark of sort of libertarianism. And people were saying, no, you don't want to do things. That's the collective. You know, you don't want to do things a community. It's all individual and companies. And yeah, you got to make money off of everything. And we go, well, and you know, now if the computer stuff was coming along, there'd be more of a, I don't know. But I think that's a good challenge, and it'd be interesting to get these architects together and say, why are they being more successful? And I do think that people haven't heard about the pattern languages so much, and then some people are just mystified when they look at it too. You know, some people just eat it up. It's just like, this is the best thing I've ever seen. But But a lot of people go, what? I don't understand. What's a pattern? And to me, I do want to demystify it and say, it's not a recipe, but it's just kind of a concept that you can use if you want, you know?
Let's move on to Peter.
Yeah.
And you've got two questions, combine them into one or however you want to handle it.
Oh, you know, it's not a burning question. What was it about anti-patterns or whether those could be shadow patterns as we identify them in practice, they could be opportunities for interacting with people who are kind of caught up in those patterns. And we see a lot of dark pattern in interaction, you know, patterns in interaction design, information behavior. And when we identify these, there might be ways to intervene and to flip them to the, you know, to the bright, shiny pattern that it's actually kind of a flip side of. So the behaviors might not need to change so much as the value of how that behavior is being used.
Yeah. No, I agree. I don't know sort of the best way to represent them. I mean, I really thought that coming up with the way you think things ought to be is the good way to organize a book. You don't want, well, this is the way you think it ought to be. And then, oh, don't do it this way. Oh, do the, you know, the consistency, I think, is part of the beauty of the pattern languages, but then you kind of, you sort of lose, I don't know if you lose it necessarily, but how's the best way to portray the stuff that's trying to make it, you know, that's pushing it one way. What we're trying to do is just sort of divert, you know, you could do it this way, this way, or this way, but maybe you want to go that way. And they go, oh, okay. And then if enough people are going that way over another way.
Ah, well, that's the key. You've got to get those people identifying the patterns and being able to communicate together around them. And okay. So we're all kind of talking to the same kind of friendly faces all the time.
Yeah.
So how do we get, are there ways to get beyond that? If we actually, so one of the ways that I teach system dynamics and causal loops, and which are often, you know, they look like engineering diagrams to people at first and everything. And the way that we approach this, that I approach learning system dynamics models and the kind of behavioral loops that demonstrate problems within systems is to use, you know, what are called the archetypes. So these are like success to the successful, which is like the rich keep getting richer. And there's a pattern for that.
Yeah.
And fixes that fail, which is that we underestimate what it's going to take to, you know, to address a problematic situation, and we address the symptom and not the underlying problem. So when we, there's, you know, tragedy of the commons, shifting the burden, these have colorful names. And once we can identify those, we know kind of how to intervene. And until we have a name for it, we don't know sometimes what we're dealing with, or we can say the rich are getting richer, but what if we flip that?
Yeah.
You know, so, well, it isn't always flipping to the other pattern, because rich getting richer wouldn't be successful. You can't just flip that to a downward spiral, which is the same pattern in the other direction. You have to have ways to intervene, but some of them do call into mind, like the pattern could be the reverse. The fix is the fail. You deal with the underlying problem instead of, you know, instead of the symptom. Yeah. So you start to identify where's the best way to introduce the pattern or to address the failure of patterns. I mean, because we see that with nudges, like in behavioral conditioning used in policy. Unfortunately, I have to say policy design, because this is a thing in design now, is designing policies using kind of the Sunstein nudging kind of philosophy. And when you really look at that closely, it becomes kind of a dark pattern. Maybe we don't all want to be nudged. Maybe we'd like to be aware of what's being asked and have some choice. And So when we become aware of what patterns are being used, that's just my thought, is that, you know, maybe it's like a different addendum to the book now. Here, if you see these patterns, use these shadow patterns, use these other ones to address them.
Yeah, well, I totally, I mean, I've been sort of harping on the if the thing doesn't have a name, you can't talk about it or even maybe think about it. And so that's one of the reasons I've been pushing this civic intelligence, because it's not collective intelligence. It's a type of collective intelligence, but why would we assume that collective intelligence would be done for good? You know, I was just reading a thing today. The U.S. Special Forces were doing a redesign so they can have more innovative sorties. And I thought, well, geez, I mean, maybe sometimes that's a good idea. I don't know. But it wasn't where I would, the first place I would want to be focusing. But so do these things have, you know, you were saying the rich get richer. I mean, maybe that is the name of that sort of, because that'd be an interesting deck of cards. These, all these different little things that are goof tricking us up all the time. I mean, I guess they're anti-patterns. Or, yeah.
Well, see, the systems people, I don't know if others agree with this, but I just, my observation, because we teach systems thinking and systemic design course. We also teach, I don't teach it, but I work with these methods, strategic foresight or futures thinking.
Oh, Peter, you're breaking up, Peter.
Yeah, I was wondering.
Quite optimistic, or at least driven by, it's going to be at least one dark scenario. One dark scenario, at least, but the general trend is optimistic. Systems thinking tends to be problem, you know, identifying problematics and addressing underlying symptoms. It can be pessimistic because we start seeing the underbelly of how things actually work. Mm-hmm. And so it leads to a more critical viewpoint on things and trying to address fundamental system change, which may lead to positive outcomes, but we don't use always just positive thinking to get there. We often, you know, use, we look for the critical patterns and try to intervene in those and transform them. It makes you look critical a lot, though.
I'm going to move us along because our list of people who want to ask questions is getting longer. So Kelly had asked a few different questions. Kelly, do you have something you'd like to comment or ask? Do we lose Kelly?
No, I just couldn't get off mute.
Okay. Go ahead, Kelly.
Okay, so my most pressing question is related to the visuals and who chooses the visuals, because I think that you just said something with regards to if you don't have a word, you can't you can't have a dialogue. Dan, you might want to jump in here with me to clarify, but you know, we're working with a colleague in Amsterdam with regards to words, and I believe that he said that, you know, when we hear a word, we get a visual image in our mind, and we're able to act upon from that. So that's my general question to you.
Well, basically, with the visuals in our in the Liberating Voices pattern language, I asked people if they came up with, if they had some ideas of what they thought would be good. I'm interested in visual stuff, but I don't know what I'm doing, really. And so basically with ours, I saw kind of a, I don't know what they maybe in the movies it's called a palette, maybe, but like with ours, we decided not to use cartoon images. And I think people use cartoon images because then they can, it's not copyright, or they're not worrying about stealing copyright. So anyway, all of ours had to be in the public domain, and they had to be shareable. I was kind of partial to using paintings in a lot of situations, and I don't think it maybe travels that well. But you know, we used the Duchamp, the large glass, or the, I forget what it's called, for one of them. And
I saw the Gleaners.
Yeah, the Gleaners is there.
To Gritta. So it seemed like it certainly had a range in terms of, it wasn't static or something that was fairly current.
Yeah. And like I say, I'm kind of old school. I never thought I would say that, but I'm here, you know, now I'm almost 70. And so the things that I thought were kind of cool, I don't know how cool they were. One thing that with the languages, when you make another translation of one of them, and you can change the image. You can change the image and make it more context relevant, which I think is a big plus. It's interesting, when I was doing the workshop in Shanghai, the fact that at that point, all the patterns, no matter what language, did have the same image on them. So I could look down at the table, and if the Chinese people were using it, I knew what patterns they were using. And so that was kind of an unexpected plus. I certainly wouldn't insist on it. You know, if something was going to be used, you know, in China, there's no reason to save the image just because Doug likes it. but so, you know, I've always thought that it would be really great if there was really somebody handling the image thing, you know, the visuality, because, you know, my vision of what they should be is not necessarily the best. I mean, neither is it the best in terms of the verbiage. I had a student that said, you need to translate the cards into everyday language. You know, they sound like they're too, you know, academic and that sort of thing. And I think the person's right. One person said, you ought to translate those so my kindergartner could use them, which I thought was absolutely brilliant. I mean, I loved the concept. You know, I don't know, they wouldn't, I don't think you could translate them one to one, but, you know, I think giving people ideas without telling them what to do is a good thing. And at the core what the patterns are supposed to do. The guy that translated them into Arabic said, I'd like to translate these into street Arabic, you know, and I hadn't, you know, to me, Arabic was Arabic. I never really thought about, oh, you got street Arabic and then you got the academic Arabic. Of course you do. You know, why would that language not be like other languages in some ways? And, but yeah, I think that's it's really, the visuals are very important, and I don't know. I was disappointed that that they wouldn't let me put a visual in for every pattern in the book, because Alexander's book, you could just flip through it and you go, wow, that is one cool photo. There's another cool photo, it was a bit of a bait and switch. They said I could in the beginning, and when it got right down to it, they said, no, it's kind of a hassle for us. But yeah, so I don't, I don't know if I was answering any questions specifically, but that's, you know, one.
Let's move on to, Stephen.
Okay.
Stephen?
Thanks very much.
Sure. Thank you.
Oh, hi there. Yeah, Douglas, I was just wondering, sort of like Peter was saying, you know how you have these kind of contextual pieces, like where things, you know, how much can things change or not change? Like, I was wondering how scale plays into it, you know, because you've got, like, I find often things get pushed into one scale or one context, you know, maybe how can I facilitate a workshop? And then I'm facilitating the workshop. So I know I've got a group, I've got me. It's still complex, so it's good. Or maybe, you know, you're building a house. So it's, you've got some container on it. When things start to move between scales, I'm wondering sometimes whether you need some, like an extra parameter, maybe the quality of the space, the quality of the scale in combination with the pattern, or the nature of the systems and systems that are being combined. Is it, you know, is it a system which is, you know, in one location, or have you got more than one location? And then does that need to be an extra parameter that goes with the pattern language card or something like that? So I wonder what your thoughts are.
Right. Well, it's interesting because I mean, I think that that question is really super relevant for the patterns that we came up with, and they're less relevant with the patterns that Alexander came up with, because those are intended to be used to build a building, you know, basically. I mean, some of them are not, but a lot of them are pretty practical. And when you have something like civic intelligence, it is applicable at so many different scales. One person can be sort of an agent of civic intelligence. A group could be, you could talk about an entire city or region, country, the planet, you know, you can talk about it in many ways. And you can use the pattern in different ways too. You could use the pattern, we're going to do a poster campaign where we're going to focus on civic intelligence. You could say, I'm going to start an organization focused on civic intelligence. I'm going to make a game. So it's so very much open-ended with this realm that the liberating voices are in. But I wonder if, you know, you talked about adding a parameter. I mean, that would be interesting. There's always the idea of if you add too much stuff. I mean, maybe another way to do it would be to say for civic intelligence, to have better examples. You know, this is... we used it this way. We used it that way, you know, because if somebody said, well, how can I use civic intelligence? I would rather not say, you can do it. You can use it in any scale and with any project. And what, even though I think that is actually true, it's, you want to be able to narrow, you know, your organization, and you want to do some sort of a campaign. Which ones should I use that were, which patterns should I use that would be useful for what I'm doing? You know, if you could just click, a few key buttons, and then all of a sudden you get the patterns that are really specific for you, it'd be great. But it's, haven't been able to really figure out how to do that. What's sort of the best way, which leaves them at some pretty open-ended kind of daunting potential. So I don't think I specifically answered your question, but I realize how important it is, especially in terms of usability of these. People don't want to idly glance at them and say, well, that's a cool idea.
No, I think so. So it's something that's been, it's something that sort of, you see the relevance. It's finding ways to make that work, isn't it, in a way that's practical. Yeah. Cool. Thanks.
Yeah, definitely. That's the problem.
Joanne?
Yes. I do have a few questions, and I wrote a couple of in the chat, but I think I'll summarize into one question. I do sort of see the practicality side of identifying patterns within the context of complex systems. So I do understand the Alexander's notion of patterns. They're very much proven known solutions to recurring or repeatable problems. So you have a problem, you identify the proven working solutions. Now, there are a whole set of problems. I think in the Acuff language, they're emergent problems or wicked problems, where the problem domain cannot be clearly defined or understood because the underlying system's constantly shifting and changing.
Yeah.
So, and then we're talking about emergent patterns. That means they are formed on the fly as things change, as things interact. I looked through the library before this meeting, and it was a very, very rich set of patterns, and many of them are very useful. So my question is two. One is, have you used any of the patterns in the Liberating Voices library or set? So that's first question. My second question is, have you attempted using actually identifying emergent patterns to help dealing with wicked problems, because these problems cannot be really identified and defined in a clear-cut sense as we did, as Alexander did, as you did here. However, identifying these emergent patterns will help us understanding the nature or even the underlying structure of the potential problem, the really deep in, and then finding interventions, very much experiments that may or may not work. You know, COVID is one example. We've got many other examples, mental health, poverty, so on and so forth, problems that cannot really be solved by known solutions and known problem understandings. I'll stop there. Thank you very much, by the way. It's very inspiring.
I've been trying to I have a Google alert that comes every day on wicked problems. And so that's when I knew about this special forces wicked problems. I mean, I thought maybe the wicked problem is we have special forces, but they're talking about firefighting, they're talking about policing, taxation. I mean, everything is now going under this title. And to me, it's kind of a good thing, because it seems like there's a growing number of people that are saying, we can't solve these problems. I mean, it's like almost like, help me, you know? And I mean, everybody's trying, you know, it's not that we say, this is too wicked, so I'm out of here, you know? So there are characteristics, you know, and I think that's part of it, is to think, what are sort of the indicators, you know, in any little given problem? How do we know that we have a climate change problem? Well, because of carbon in the atmosphere, the temperature in the ocean, the height of, you know, and so that's part of it. I was reading I read this one, you know, the papers are coming in faster than I'm ever going to read them, that's for sure. But there was this thing on biodiversity and animals. And the guy was saying there's about 9 things that people do. You know, one of the things they do is education about trading in animals that shouldn't be traded. And so now you have at least some of the potential patterns would be each of these 9 things. And then what's the different mix, you know, in different places? You can pull out aspects of what you can do, what needs to be done. Maybe there's ways, like with the climate change, one of the patterns that you can do, you could do it in your own house. Maybe you could do it at your university. You could do it in your city, is carbon audit. How are you contributing to the carbon pollution? And so to me, that's a pattern. And then all the different ways of going about it, you either make up something or you see what somebody else has done already. And I sort of think that these are wicked problems. They are very difficult, but that doesn't mean that the pieces, that we can't look at some of the pieces. And, you know, one of the limitations that we have is everybody that's interested in doing something about climate change, you're not going to have a conversation with all those people. You know, say there's, I don't know, let's just say there's 50 million people. So I'm not going to talk with 50 million and they're not going to talk with 50 million people. And so what are the, how do we do the loose coordination? To me, loose coordination is a pattern. And you think, well, how do you do that loose coordination? And I've made a list of like 15 ways that you do it. One is you start using the same sort of vocabulary. One is you use the same goals. What, you know, we're actually sort of doing it already. But, you know, the question is, could you do it better? And so I think that you could. And so part of the function of a pattern is to facilitate this loose coordination. Because, you know, I'm not going to solve the climate change problem in my neighborhood and expect that to make any difference in the world. But if there's a federation of neighborhoods that happens to pop up and this is what we did here. And so, you know, you might do it there. And so, you know, there are these sort of large scale collaborations that are happening. They're basically in the science community. And, you know, arguably it's easier for them to do it, but I think we could do something along those lines. That's kind of my take. And I think that if we started, I don't know, like if half of us started saying, well, we're gonna sort of look at this Green New Deal thing that Doug put together and we're gonna get rid of the bad stuff and make it better and we're gonna market it and I don't know. You know, it's this is what my focus at the moment is like, you know, shearing it off the pot, basically, you know. Whenever I'm done with my spiel, I always think, did I even get remotely close to what the person was asking, you know? But
let's move on to Robert, because Robert had a question.
Okay.
Sure. Maybe I'll just read it out and then expand. So I said, what's the difference between patterns, words, concepts, and memes? Do pattern languages add a sort of expressive capacity beyond what our natural languages already give us? So you started the call by referencing, I think, lingua franca, and talked about how patterns have been used for sort of a form of translation in different contexts. And I attended a seminar recently at collective intelligence is a sort of central topic of interest of mine. So I attended a seminar by Pierre Levy, who talked of IEML, which is a meta language sort of concept. But I was curious, do patterns, because I know David's put this idea in my head of that sometimes these are just catalogs and they don't exactly exist as like a language that you can compose, say, sentences or expressions within. So I don't know, maybe you could expand on that a little bit. If you've seen pattern languages used more like a language, and how where are they getting us further in a way, is my question.
Well, one thing that one thing I was going to say, if I can remember, the pattern languages to me, from a sort of a, I don't know if I want to say academic, that's such a negative word these days, but sort of intellectually, you've got laws or you've got things that people really believe to be true. You know, water evaporates, this, you know, and then you've got like recipes, do this and that, and then when you're done, add 3 jiggers of XYZ. And so the pattern languages, the patterns represent something sort of in the middle. They're not intended to be true. They're not supposed to be, they're supposed to be interpretable, but they're supposed to represent something that's worthwhile or, you know, for thinking or for action. And so it's, I think that I don't want to make extravagant claims for them, you know, and that's one thing. I think some people with pattern is it's gotta be, it doesn't always work. I said, no, it doesn't. It doesn't always work. And what in life always works. And so I think in just in terms of sort of a linguistic function, to be around somewhere in the middle. In fact, I think that's one of Alexander's patterns is you want something vague, you know, kind of in the middle, but so sort of linguistically, I think that they do something. And I think naming them as patterns, but naming them with specific things like this demystification and re-enchantment. I mean, now that we all sort of talked about it here, we might, you know, walk outside and look at some tree and say, wow, that's a hell of a tree, you know, and I don't know. But so now have people used them as a language. I think that speaking of languages, and I've noticed this with students because they didn't have any choice really. I mean, they didn't have to sign up for the class, but when we kept working with these patterns, people used them in their discourse, you know, and they begin to think with them, like thinking with a word or thinking with a meme or thinking with these concepts, like you're saying. So I think that it's maybe not 100% natural to automatically just take off with them. You know, there's a certain sort of learning curve, but it's, you know, call it pattern literacy or something. And I noticed it, you know, that it was actually giving us more sort of tools tools for thought, which is kind of, I think, what words and concepts and those things that you mentioned are. We use them because they help us to accomplish something. And so, it's a good question. And the whole linguistic aspect of it is pretty fascinating, because that's the other thing people ask. Why, first of all, what's a pattern? Second of all, pattern language? Why is it a language, you know, instead of, say, a catalog, you know?
So I think we're going to wind down soon. For the last question, and this could be a surprise, because Tim has this habit of sneaking in after all the introductions are done. So Tim actually had asked me in advance whether he could get the opportunity to ask questions. So Tim, I'll give you the opportunity now.
That is downright devious and nasty, Dana. Okay, yeah, I didn't have a question on the top of my mind, but I guess what I was really resonating with me that I was hearing was the sort of, I keep having this word go through my head, I think it's kind of a highfalutin word from some philosopher guy, but that bricolage idea. Douglas seemed to speak to that earlier on, and you know, kind of a patchwork of things and more pragmatic orientation to selection. And then someone else in the chat mentioned in the phrasing of their sentence, patterns of or patterns for complexity. And it kind of seemed to resonate with what Joanne, I think, was trying to get at there. But do you have like a pointer? So I'm inventing a question as I can synthesize one here. You know, is there a pointer in that direction? Because that's the most pointy end of the stick, you know, the most there that I'm hearing. If I'm looking for some direction to take pattern languages beyond the shortcomings or failures of their attempt to be used in the past or disappointing impact of this or that, you know, where do you look to, or where are people looking to for affordances that are up to the task of this composable wisdom for complex, wicked problems in ways that kind of accept our ignorance and
inefficacy? I appreciate that question. I'm not 100% sure I'm understanding all of it. Are you talking about ways for people to sort of, I'll say, cut and paste with patterns and get a bunch and sort of put them together and see how it happens?
I just mean, actually not specifically, but given all the tools that you've looked at for kind of trying to self-organize responses to difficult challenges in specifically, say, a civic intelligence domain or mindset dealing with issues that people tend to focus on, whether it's climate change or adaptation or these kinds of things that we point to typically these days. You know, it doesn't have to be a card kit or a particular card or anything, but, you know, what's the hope? Where's the direction of in terms of tooling? Let's put it that way, in the most general sense, tooling or method. What direction do you think you might point to for overcoming these failures and shortcomings of the past?
Boy, my baby monitor is on, so now I'm hearing Nico. My grandson is now on the other floor.
That's a perfect answer, by the way.
Try not to listen to
a future generation.
Yeah, exactly. But so I think that we're talking about how would I suggest to sort of get in there and use them.
And let me come at it from the other side.
Okay.
I'm frustrated by the fact that we as people seem to have too much blocky structures in our heads, and we have papers and diagrams, and we talk to each other in these languages of these things, and we don't get anywhere. So
I'm frustrated by the sort of that conceit, if you like, in the literary sense of how we view the world or how we approach collaboration on these wicked problems. And it seems like they just simply don't fall to that kind of equipment. So, but in the absence of, you know, I mean, when you turn away from nice straight lines and arrows and dotted lines and, you know, objects in a diagram or patterns or words, or when you turn away from these things, where do you look to? Which direction can you look for some kind of a strategy or an action to take that can undermine and undermine the barriers, you know, make them dissolve more than they seem to representational?
Yeah, I mean, that's sometimes people say things like, we need a whole new way of thinking. And I think, well, maybe we do, but a lot of the new ways of thinking I can think about would be terrible. It would be 10 times worse than we have it now, even though many of us know that we do have to change the way we think. And so I think that it's part of the reality of the situation, but I think it's viable, is that one of the first things I think that would be really important for people to start realizing or thinking about is that these problems sort of affect everybody, and that everybody does have some way in which they might play a part. And the other thing is that sort of drop these ideas that there's going to be a silver bullet and that everything is going to go away if you just get the diagrams right. And so that's sort of the big picture is just that we don't have it, and we might not ever get the big picture. And so, in fact, that's what I think intelligence is that you always have to do something, and you always do it with incomplete information. The idea of total information is completely impossible. I mean, you know, and so part of it, I think, on that level, is that we sort of abandon the idea that we have to do things by ourselves, think about ways that we could leverage each other's stuff better, try to sort of build sort of bigger assemblages, throw that in with bricolage, I guess, of people that are working together. And then I think that on a smaller scale, you know, I can use those lines and those diagrams, and, you know, it's not that those things are totally useless. It's just to realize that they're not everything. And then, so I think, to the question that you didn't really ask, I thought you were maybe, is how to start getting putting these networks together of things that work, of approaches that you want to take, knowing that one won't work by itself. And you know, say that you think education is part of working with climate change. And so you think, how do I educate people around, or how do we educate ourselves in our local communities? And then you say, well, let's find out what people are doing in other communities. And then say, what kind of projects? Yeah, now I don't think I'm going anywhere particularly novel, but I think those sort of high level generalities are important and could kind of go a long way. I mean, some of my students said, you know, I used to think I have no power at all. And, well, that's too bad. But and then they said, you know, my power is limited, but it's not zero. And so that's part of it. But still, I'm thinking I'm not really getting 100% at what you're asking, which I wish I was.
No, I think that you did. You did in your own way. What I got out of that was maybe the direction is to a little more inculcating a little more humility. Maybe it's in education systems or something to try to, you know, even if we don't have the positive answer, maybe we can displace some of the over expectations of and extravagant claims of quote unquote modeling or things like this, because we tend to imbue them with that silver bullet attitude, like, hey, I learned AI, now I can solve climate change, right? Things like that, right? That's I think your point is maybe if we have appropriate expectations for what we can do well and are more realistic about that, it'll maybe make room.
Yeah, and also, I mean, the other side is true. You know, we don't have as much power maybe as we don't think that those quote solutions that are out there are really solutions, but we actually sort of the flip side is that I think that we have the limitations on ourselves and our limitations on our ability to work together are not, I'll say, God-given. They're not set in stone. Those limits can be sort of overcome somewhat. I'm not talking about a super brilliant whatever group mind, but we could be collaborating quite a bit better than we are now. You know, I'm still working with a lot of my students that I had, and I was not in an elite university, and those people, some of them have quite a lot of self-efficacy. They've made big changes in the way their communities do things, the way they do health, community health, and all sorts of interesting things. So. I think that's part of it too, is maybe it's the demystification and the re-enchantment.
So this is a good opportunity. I think that we should probably wrap up now, Doug. So the question that we should close with is, so on the publicsphereproject.org, I see a contact page with an email address so people can get in touch with you. What would you like to hear from people? What are you working on now? Would you like to hear?
Well, I was just sending out something, but I actually just sent it to Dan instead of to everybody. But, you know, we're trying to play around with this repository concept, which people can come online and pick the patterns they think are useful and kind of save them away. And I want to throw all other patterns in there. Looking for people to review this draft article the one that you've seen, David. And then, I don't know. I mean, I would be nice to take some kind of quote wicked problem and think about jointly creating a pattern language around that, try to market it, get people to do different pieces of it, get feedback on how well it is, try to get different communities to look at it. That would be exciting. I would love to do that.
Okay.
And also, I'd like to hear what other people have for ideas too. because I'm retired. I've got nothing to do.
So we'll keep the communication. I think we'll keep the communication channels open. So thank you so much for your time, Doug.
Thanks for asking me, David. I really enjoyed talking. I love talking about this stuff, and thanks for all the great questions. And like I said, the variety of everybody's perspectives is just always kind of very exciting.
Okay. Well, thanks.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks,
Bye-bye.